You're listening to BreadboxMedia.com. And I'm Chuck Coughlin.
And this is Setting the Record Straight.
World War II produced so many great heroes. So many that we can't pay adequate attention to many of them. The program today is a reflection on some of the heroes, some well-known, some not well-known. All of them need to be brought to our attention from time to time. Rather than talk about one person, I'm going to talk about several in sequence. If you're a regular listener to Setting the Record Straight, you know that I'm including at the end of each show a short chapter from a novel with a Catholic theme. It's called Do You Hear the Far Away? I'm presenting it in a serialized form. A chapter at a time. But let's get back to our main subject. I want to cover a bit of record of the Holocaust that doesn't get much attention. The Jews were the group that suffered the most, as a percentage of their numbers. But there were 1.2 Christians killed for every Jew in the death camps. And these people need to be remembered also. The great majority of those that were not Jewish were Catholics. Come with me now to 1944, to Poland. Two SS men knock at the door of Stefania Podgorska, a Catholic seamstress. Let me explain who the SS were. They were the protective echelon of the Nazi Party. They were founded by Adolf Hitler in 1925 as a small personal bodyguard, but they grew with the success of the Nazi movement and gathered immense police and military powers. They became virtually a state within a state. They were headed by Heinrich Himmler. The abbreviation SS stands for Schutzstaffel, which Schutzstaffel is German for protective echelon. These two men are to be feared. They talk to Stefania. Her cottage is wanted for personnel of the field hospital across the street. She and her younger sister Helena have 2 hours to move out on pain of death. The challenge of finding a new place to live is a bit harder than the SS men can imagine. Stefania is just 17, and she has a secret, something that is going to make it very difficult to move out. A secret difficulty. She is sheltering 13 Jews in her little house. Stefania spends nearly 2 hours running from house to ruined house. After occupation by the Germans, the Soviets, and then the Germans again, there's no building left to make a decent house in. She returns home. Her Jewish guests beg her to escape, taking just Helena, who is only 7. Eva Fogelman, a psychotherapist whose father was rescued by Lithuanian Catholics, has written a splendid book about people who saved Jews. The book is called Conscience and Courage. In it, she reports Stefania's own account of what happened next. Stefania asked her guests to pray with her. She knelt before a picture of Jesus and Mary. And here in Stefania's words, she describes what happened next.
And I ask God not to let us be killed.
Help, somehow.
I cannot leave this apartment. I cannot leave 13 people for a certain death. I will be alive if I go, but 13 lives will be finished. Children, too, and young people. I ask God, help, somehow.
And I heard a voice. It was a woman's voice.
It was so beautiful. So nice, so quiet. She said to me, "Don't worry. Everything will be all right. You will not leave your apartment. You will stay here, and they will take only one room. Everything will be all right. I'm with you." And she told me, "Be quiet. I'll tell you what to do." She said, "Send your people to the bunker, a hidden space in the attic. Open the door. Open the windows. Clean your apartment and sing." Stefania obeyed the voice. Her neighbors came
and protested and warned her
the SS would surely kill her. She continued to clean her house and to sing. 10 minutes later, an SS man arrived, smiling. It was a good thing, he said, that she'd not move, because they needed only one room. She could keep the rest.
There were many more close calls even before that. And there were close calls after that. Finally, the Soviets arrived and liberated the town. But Stefania and Helena Podgorska
and the 13 Jews all survived the war. Eva Fogelman interviewed more than 300 rescuers and checked their stories with the Jews they saved and with official records. She wanted to understand what motivated people to risk their lives to help others. She concluded that in many cases, the critical motive was religious faith, the conviction that Christ would want them to do this. But what of the official church? From time to time, there's fresh eruptions of stories about the alleged inaction of the Catholic hierarchy, and especially the, quote, silence of the Pope, Pope Pius XII. Some of these stories are worse slander in ways even than the scurrilous 1963 play, The Deputy. Even The New Yorker, in its April 7, 1997 edition, printed an article that asserted Pius and the hierarchy turned their backs on the Jews, and journals such as the Catholic Times and the National Catholic Register, owned by the Legionnaires of Christ, in reporting the progress of a document on the Holocaust being prepared by the Pontifical Commission for Religious Relations with the Jews, treat the question as an open question. It's not an open question. Let's set the record straight on that. Probably the most systematic and comprehensive study of the Pope's and the hierarchy's handling of the Holocaust is Pincus Lapide's 1967 book, Three Popes and the Jews. Lapide, an Israel diplomat, was a member of the Palestinian Brigade that found many interned Jews in Italy at the end of World War II. After exhaustive research, Lapide concluded that at least 700,000 Jews, and more likely 860,000, owed their lives directly to the Catholic Church. He also concluded that Pope Pius XII simply could not have done more than he did. The suggestion that Pius ought to have spoken more forcefully, he treats with near derision. He quotes many Jewish leaders, many of them rescued by Catholics, to the effect that the more forceful speeches certainly would not have caused the Nazis to moderate the persecutions, and most probably would have induced them to intensify them. Not that the Pope was silent. As early as 1935, as Vatican Secretary of the State Cardinal Pacelli, later Pope Pius XII, addressed 250,000 pilgrims at Lourdes, he said, "These Nazi ideologues are in fact only miserable plagiarizers who dress up ancient error in new tinsel. It matters little whether they rally round the flag of the social revolution or are possessed by the superstition of race and blood." Cardinal Pacelli was responsible for the final wording of Pope Pius XI encyclical 1937, with burning sorrow, mit brennen der Sorge, and made it more strongly anti-racist. This encyclical, with burning sorrow, the first ever written in German, was read in all the churches in Germany on Palm Sunday. The Nazi Foreign Office characterized it as, quote, a call to battle, as it calls upon Catholic citizens to rebel against the authority of the Reich. In 1938, Italy passed its first anti-Jewish laws. Pius XI condemned them. He took action as well. In January, he asked the ambassadors to the Vatican to procure entry visas to their countries for German and Italian Jews. He also called a German bishop to Rome to plan a resettlement project in San Paolo. Presumably his Secretary of State was involved in these initiatives. Pacelli was the live spirit which stood behind all the anti-German activities of the Catholic Church's policy in opposing them. But then Pope Pius XI died in February. Cardinal Pacelli was elected as Pius XII in March. As one of the standard first steps in the persecution, Jews were now banned from the learned professions. The new Pope invited many to his Vatican and offered to help them to emigrate. Many accepted, and Pius intervened with the diplomats of other countries to obtain entry visas for them. Italy declared war on France in June of 1940. The Pope was determined to keep the Vatican neutral in order to make it a refuge. He brought the diplomats of nations at war with the Axis into the papal hospice of Santa Marta, close to the Holy Office and the German College. He assigned the Holy Office to develop its contacts throughout Europe
into a chain of agents who would deal with intelligence, prisoners of war, and refugees.
One of the most fascinating rescuers of the war, Monsignor Hugh O'Flaherty, Primo Notario of the Holy Office, thus became involved early on in the Vatican's information gathering and humanitarian activities. Informally also, as he lived in the German college, next door to the diplomat's new quarters.
There's another interesting story. During June of that year, some 500 Jews left Bratislava in a small boat bound for Palestine. 4 months later, the boat tried to enter the harbor at Istanbul and was denied permission. An Italian patrol boat picked up the passengers and took them to a prison camp on Rhodes, warned that they were to be handed over to the Germans. These Jews sent one of their number to Rome, where he obtained an audience with the Pope. The Pope put pressure on Mussolini's Italian government, and all 500 were interned in southern Calabria, where they survived the war. Picus Lapide reports arriving at Fedamonte Tarsia to find 3,200 Jews, mostly refugees from Austria, Czechoslovakia, and Hungary. They had been not only saved by papal intervention, but also fed, clad, and looked after at Vatican expense by two papal emissaries who set up a kosher kitchen
and organized a school for the children. It's time for a break now on Setting the Record Straight with Chuck Coughlin. We're coming to you, as you well know, on BreadboxMedia.com. When we come back, we'll consider more of the heroism of Catholics during the time of the Second World War.
Breadbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit breadboxmedia.com.
You're listening to breadboxmedia.com. And I'm Chuck Coughlin.
And this is Setting the Record Straight.
We were talking specifically at the moment that we broke about Pope Pius XII's strenuous and heroic efforts on behalf of the Jews during the Holocaust. But even giving all the Pope's efforts, does this qualify him as a rescuer, as someone who risked his own life to save the Jews? In 1940, Martin Bormann prepared Operation Pontiff on Hitler's instruction. Pope Pius XII was to be imprisoned in a monastery on the Wartburg. Lapide think it is probable that the Pope knew of the plan. If so, it did not deter him. As the Nazi persecutions of the Jews intensified, and as it spread to the countries occupied by German forces, so did Vatican efforts at rescue and shelter. And Pius instructed the European hierarchy to follow his lead. "There is no doubt," said Leon Poliakov, a Jewish historian of the Holocaust, "that secret instructions went out from the Vatican, urging the national churches to intervene in favor of the Jews by every possible means." Even in the heart of the Reich, even in Germany, Catholic bishops protested the treatment of the Jews. Priests spoke out against Nazism and paid for it with their lives, Catholic laymen sheltered Jews. Hitler came to power in 1933. In December of that year, Cardinal Michael Fohaber, the Lion of Munich, delivered a sermon in defense of biblical Judaism. When the persecution escalated, he spoke directly to the point. He said, "God has always punished the tormentors of the Jews. No Roman Catholic approves of the persecution of the Jews in Germany." In October of 1938, the chief rabbi of Munich told the cardinal that he feared his synagogue would be burned. The cardinal provided a truck to transport the Torah scrolls and other important things from the synagogue for safekeeping into his palace. Nazi mobs gathered outside the cardinal's palace, screaming, "Away with Fohaber, the Jew friend."
There's so many interesting stories, but I want to tell you another one about Stefania, the 17-year-old girl whose bravery I told about at the beginning of the program. It was the year before that, when she was 16, that the Nazis came and occupied the town and began to enforce the usual laws. Stefania's reaction at age 16 was pure perplexity. What was behind this? Was there something wrong with the Jewish people that she and her inexperience had never known? Or were the Germans just being unfair? Stefania was employed in a small grocery store owned by the Diamant family, a Jewish family. She helped them pack their belongings and move into the ghetto. The Diamants asked her to live in the apartment over their store so she could keep an eye on it. Her 6-year-old sister, Helena, had come to join her. Stefania took a job in the local factory. She bought food and smuggled it to the Diamants regularly. When the deportations began, Mrs. Diamant was sent to Auschwitz. One of her sons, Isaac, was moved to a concentration camp. He was killed while trying to escape. Two other sons, Joseph and Hennick, were deported from the ghetto. They jumped from the moving train. Joseph had a loaf of bread that Stefania had smuggled him, hidden in his shirt. When he jumped, he was impaled on a spike sticking out of a telegraph pole. The bread saved him, only his clavicle was broken. 2 days later, he appeared at his old home, at Stefania's door. After she nursed him back to health, he returned to the ghetto and brought back a young woman named Danuta, who was engaged to marry Hennick. Joseph and Danuta took over smuggling food to the ghetto. Hennick returned there, and there were many other friends still inside. Stefania continued to work in the factory. She also found a place, a 13-mile walk each way, where she could sell her clothes for milk and butter. But there was little point in keeping their friends in the ghetto alive until the Nazis got around to sending them to Auschwitz. Stefania went out to search for a house for them in the deserted Jewish quarter. This is what Stefania wrote about that day. I didn't know where to go. Everything was empty and I was scared. It was so ghostly. Then I heard a voice. I heard a voice while I stood there thinking, asking, "Dear God, where am I supposed to go now for an apartment? Where?" I looked around, and I was frightened because nobody was there. And then I heard the voice. Some voice told me, "Don't be afraid, go a little farther." After this corner, two women are standing. Women who clean the street. They are supporting themselves on their brooms. Ask them for an apartment. They will tell you. And I felt a little push. And the voice said, "Go ahead, ask for the janitor there." So Stefania walked past the corner and found the two women with leaning on their brooms. She asked them about an apartment. They told her of a cottage. They told her to ask for the janitor, who would show it to her. So Stefania rented the cottage. She, Joseph, and Danuta brought Hennick, a neighbor, and two children there from the ghetto. Two Jewish businessmen, the fathers of the two children, were to follow. They planned to bribe the Polish mailman to bring them in his cart. 10 minutes after these men were due to arrive, two German soldiers and two Polish policemen appeared in front of Stefania's house. They remained there for 3 hours, and the mail cart did not come. Over the protests of her guests, Stefania went out to talk to the policemen. They told her that the Germans had been warned that two wealthy Jews would be leaving the ghetto and coming to her street. "The Germans ordered us to catch the Jews, but they don't trust us. We don't believe any Jews are coming, so they're watching us, watching them." Stefania managed to smile, and then she walked to a nearby church and begged God to send the soldiers and the policemen away. When she returned to the cottage, the soldiers and the policemen were gone, and the two men had arrived. The rest of Stefania's 13 guests would escape the ghetto during its final liquidation and find their way to the cottage. Stefania would feed and clothe them all and keep them hidden from the German nurses who occupied that one room that the Nazis had taken. Her little sister Helena helped. Now, past her 7th birthday, she was quick and nimble. She became expert at smuggling messages to and from the ghetto. Once she was chased by a gang of boys. As she ran, she tore the note she carried into small pieces and swallowed them. The boys caught her and beat her. A few weeks before the end of the war, the hospital across the street was closed and the nurses moved out. Then the town was liberated. Two Soviet soldiers came to the cottage, hoping to barter chocolate for vodka. Stefania's Jewish friends overheard that the Germans had retreated. They came out of hiding. The soldiers were astonished. Two girls hid these people, they said to each other. Not even two, a girl and a half. In Lithuania, only one-fifth of the Jews survived the Holocaust. Churches and underground leaders protested. Priests, peasants, and nuns hid many Jews. Anna Semianté, a famous literary critic, was in charge of the cataloging department at Vilna University. She recalled this about it. When the Germans forced the Jews of Vilna into a ghetto, I could no longer go on with my work. I could not remain in my study. I could not eat. I had to do something. I realized the danger involved, but it could not be helped. A force much stronger than myself was at work. Non-Jews were not allowed in the ghetto. She went to the German authorities and got permission to go in and to retrieve books the Jewish students had borrowed. She found people outside the ghetto who would shelter Jewish children and spirited them out. She was able to get forged identity papers for Jews who climbed over the ghetto wall and smuggled in foods, small arms, and ammunition. Besides the library books where they were supposedly her mission, she carried out letters from ghetto leaders and diaries of ghetto life. These diaries were invaluable records that she hid in the university vaults. Another Catholic young woman, Jadzia Deniak, brought weapons to the fighting unit in Vilna and served a courier and liaison between the ghetto and the outside world. She was captured and executed by the Nazis. There was a man, Joseph Stokoskis, was in charge of the archives of Vilna. He hid 12 Jews in his office. At a Benedictine convent near Vilna, there were 7 nuns. The Mother Superior was only 35 years old. The nuns established an underground railroad from the Vilna ghetto to their convent. They hid escaping Jews there and in other places. They smuggled knives, guns, and even hand grenades into the ghetto. The Mother Superior acted as liaison between the ghetto leaders and the underground outside. There's another story about the rescue network. It's a story about Deborah Biron. It was 1941. Deborah was just 6 years old. She'd been living with her parents in a ghetto near Kovno for a year and a half. One night her mother told her that when the forced labor detail returned through the ghetto gate, she and another little girl would pass among them and leave. They were to look for a woman in a black coat with a white flower. The two little girls did as they were told. The woman, a Lithuanian Catholic who became known to them only as Natasha, tossed them into a hay wagon. A German officer standing nearby told her, "I know what you're up to. You have exactly 1 minute to get out of here with the children or I will shoot." Well, I'm sure you're wondering what happened next. Well, here on BreadboxMedia.com, on Setting the Record Straight. Are we going to find out what happened next? Yes, we are. Right after this break. This is Chuck Coughlin.
Breadbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit breadboxmedia.com.
You're listening to breadboxmedia.com. And I'm Chuck Coughlin.
And this is Setting the Record Straight.
We were just talking about the experience of Deborah, a little girl,
who was attempting to escape by hiding in a hay wagon.
Natasha drove the wagon for 3 hours to a farm. She left Deborah there and took the other child to another farm. At first, Natasha often came to visit Deborah. She told her that there were several other farms in the area that were sheltering other children. After a month, Natasha took Deborah to another farm. Eventually, Deborah's mother joined her there. Another Jewish woman and her daughter came as well, and that child's godparents. The Nazi persecution intensified. The family and their guests built a bunker next to the cellar. They worked at night loading dirt into sacks, which the father of the family dumped in his fields, and slept during the day. When the Soviet air raids began, the family started sleeping in the regular cellar. Little Deborah vividly recalled one night when German soldiers came to the farm. They had closed the trap door of the bunker just in time. "Who's down there?" a soldier shouted. "It's only my child and me," the mother of the family called from the cellar under the kitchen. "Where's your husband?" he yelled. "He's at the front," she said. The soldier went downstairs and took a look for himself. None of us dared to breathe. When the soldier was satisfied with what he saw, he and the others left. Now I could better understand how the family were protecting us. All along, Natasha and my mother had told me what wonderful people they were. And although I liked them a lot, I didn't realize until that night that they were risking their lives for us. Many historians record Hitler's vicious rants about Pope Pius XII. Holland's special horror was to serve as a stage for Hitler's definition of the terms of what he very evidently regarded as a personal contest of wills between himself and Pope Pius XII. In 1942 in Holland, converted Jews and Jews married to Gentiles were exempted from deportation on condition that the widespread protests cease. The Protestants complied. The Archbishop of Utrecht issued another protest. As a direct result, the Germans deported all Catholics of Jewish blood, including the great martyr Edith Stein. So that no one misunderstands, I want to say that the term deported means that they were taken to the death camps. To make the message very clear, the Nazis continued to exempt the 9,000 Protestant Jews. Many Holocaust historians cite this as the definitive moment in which the Catholic Church understood that bold talk would only exacerbate the plight of the Jews. The Church decided to bluster publicly less and to do more underground. Even so, there were times when the Church deemed it strategically wise to speak out. On one of these occasions, a bishop's pastoral letter was read in all Catholic churches in Holland, deploring the injustice and asserting Catholics' obligation to testify to God's immutable laws. It cited the Pope's defense of the Jews and said, "Should the refusal of collaboration require sacrifices from you, then be strong and steadfast in the awareness that you're doing your duty before God and your fellow men." Well, if we were to judge by the numbers, many Catholics heeded this admonition. By the end of the war, 110,000 Dutch Jews were deported. 10,000 were helped to escape. 40,000 were hidden. Of the latter, 15,000 survived. 49 Catholic priests from Holland were killed for assisting Jews. Father Joseph André of Namurs rescued hundreds of Jewish children and sheltered them in convents and homes and in his own rectory. He was helped by the bishops, the Jesuits, and Sisters of Charity. One of those children, now grown up, recalled it. His name is Jacques Weinberg. One of the children he sheltered, Jacques Weinberg, recalls today. "Father André used to sit up all night, napping in his chair. He would not think of undressing and going to bed. There was the constant fear of a raid. If someone knocked on the door, Father André was on his feet. In a minute he had the children fleeing through a camouflaged exit to the neighboring house where a doctor lived. All the neighbors cooperated. Without their help, Father André could not have accomplished so much." The butchers of Namur, as well as the grocers and other merchants, provided him with food and necessities for the children. Father Edouard Foidieu organized and ran a camp for children. He rescued 300 Jewish children before he was arrested and sent to Dachau, where he managed to survive. until the camp's liberation. Jean Daman, a young Catholic teacher before the war, served as principal of an underground school for Jewish children in Brussels. When the school closed because it had become too dangerous for the children to attend, she joined the Jewish Defense Committee. She rescued many children. The Sisters of Notre Dame de Zion hid 200 Jewish children in several convents. Abbe Antoine de Brucker rescued 250 Jewish children and hid them with friendly families. He also helped 86 adults to escape, and he himself sheltered 40 more. Father Bruno Reders, a Becting from the Louvain, saved 307 Jews. You're starting to see that perhaps that I could go on and on with these stories. There's so many. In 43, Catholic radio workers helped the Jewish underground to derail the deportation trains. Hundreds of Jews escaped and found refuge with farmers. A bishop, Kerkhoff of Liege, ordered all his priests to assist the Jews. He hid the rabbi of Liege in his own residence until the end of the war. When the Germans came on a search, Lapide reports, the bishop disguised him in a cassock and introduced him to the Gestapo as his private secretary. In his diocese, some 650 Jews were successfully hidden by priests, monks, and laymen. Many French bishops protested the persecution. Some were deported. Cardinal Joliet issued pastoral letters to all Catholics of France, urging them to give Jews every assistance and refusing to surrender hidden children of deportees. One night in September of 1942, six stateless Jewish families were arrested in Lyons. The French agents gave them a choice of bringing their children along or leaving them behind. They had an hour to decide. They woke up Cardinal Joliet, who accepted the nine children. 4 days later, the prefect of Lyon was ordered to go to the cardinal's residence by Rudolf Eichmann to pick up the children. They were gone. When the prefect demanded their address, the good cardinal replied, Monsieur le Prefect, I would not consider myself worthy to be a cardinal if I complied with your request. Bonsoir. The cardinal's chief aide, Father Elder Chalet, was arrested shortly thereafter and charged with hiding 80 Jewish children. Actually, he had hidden over 200 in various public institutions and religious homes, with the active assistance of his cardinal. The cardinal spirited the children away as Chalet went to jail. The cardinal and Chalet's friends took over the work. Father Chalet was later released. By the end of the war, he had hidden 1,800 Jews in monasteries and farms. The Catholics of France obeyed their shepherds. A pro-Nazi French newspaper of Lyons printed the following. Every Catholic family shelters a Jew. The French authorities provide Jews with false identification papers and passports. Priests help them across the Swiss frontier. In Toulouse, Jewish children have been concealed in Catholic schools. The civilian Catholic officials receive intelligence of a scheduled deportation and advise a great number of refugee Jews about it. And the result is about 50% of these undesirables escape. In 43, the Vichy government, which is the part of the French government that collaborated with the Nazis, the Vichy government ordered the arrest of all Catholic priests who sheltered Jews. Within 2 months, 120 priests were arrested and sent to the camps. 400 police officers were also arrested, and 20 shot for refusing to round up Jews. More priests took over for the ones who were sent to the camps. According to Leon Polyakov, priests, members of the religious orders, and laymen were rivals in giving asylum. The Nazis, becoming impatient, scheduled a roundup of the Jews remaining in Paris for July 16, 1942. Three senior men of the church, Archbishop Saliège of Toulouse, Bishop Thias of Montauban, and Cardinal Joliet of Lyons, the primate of France, protested vehemently. Bishop Thias was imprisoned.
Archbishop Salieges'
pastoral letter was banned by the prefect of Toulouse, but still read anyway in some 400 churches. It became known as the Bomb Saliège. The Vichy government warned the nuncio's deputy that if Jews were hidden in churches or in monasteries, they would be dragged out. Father Superior Charles Devaux organized a temporary shelter from which they would transfer Jews to the homes of workmen and peasants and to convents and monasteries. Eventually, the Gestapo arrested Father Devaux.
An officer slapped him and warned him that he must stop helping Jews. But when he was later released, he continued right to the end of the war, under very dangerous conditions. We can only stand in awe of the good works performed by these Catholics during the Holocaust of the Second World War. As you know, you're listening to the wonderful global webcasting network, breadboxmedia.com. My series of programs is called Setting the Record Straight, and I'm Chuck Coughlin. I thank you for listening.
Breadbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit breadboxmedia.com.
We're back for the last segment of Setting the Record Straight. This is Chuck Coughlin on Real Life Radio and realliferadio.com, your Catholic radio network. We've been reflecting on just a few of the brave heroes of the Holocaust, especially those people who saved the Jews from the onslaught of Hitler, from Hitler's final solution. We were talking about the humanitarian efforts in France. In Nice, which was occupied by the Italian army during most of the war, Police Prefect André Chagnon invited representatives of the Jewish community to the office to tell them, "I will not allow any arbitrary acts against the Jews, nor will I leave the privilege of defending Jews to the Italians." He saved a total of 443 Jewish children and 500 adults. Father Marie Benoit, a Capuchin, had served in World War I and been wounded at Verdun. After the war, he earned a doctorate in theology at Rome. He also became a recognized authority on Judaism. When World War II broke out, Father Marie Benoit was stationed in Marseille. In the cellar of the Capuchin monastery there, he organized a forging operation, which produced hundreds of identity cards, baptismal certificates, and other kinds of identification. The good priest and other Capuchins arranged the smuggling of Jews from Marseille to Spain and Switzerland. The routes were well organized. Groups left regularly, twice each weekend, and they organized several other rescue centers in the city. Soon the Nazis occupied the free zone of France. That included Marseille. The routes to Spain and Switzerland were closed. Father Marie Benoit turned his attention to the Riviera in Haute-Savoie. Then occupied by the Italians, he went to Nice and persuaded some Italian officials to let Jews cross over into the Italian zone. In Italy, Benito Mussolini maintained for a while that Italian fascism would have nothing to do with anti-Semitism, but eventually agreed to Hitler's demands. As in Vichy France, however, the Nazis often found local Italian officials unreliable. In Italian-occupied Greece, there simply wasn't any persecution of Jews. As in France, the Nazis and fascists were quite certain that the Italian non-cooperation with the persecution was inspired by the Catholic Church. Robert Farinacci, editor of the Fascist Regime newspaper, wrote, "The Church's obstruction of the practical solution of the Jewish problem constitutes a crime against New Europe," unquote. Pope Pius XII continued to object to the persecution of Jews. Following the ghastly aftermath of the Archbishop of Utrecht's protest in 1942 in Holland, however, he spoke far more obliquely. In his famous Christmas message of 1942, he spoke with sorrow and compassion of those hundreds of thousands who, without any fault of their own, sometimes only by reason of their nationality or race, are marked for death or progressive extinction. Himmler's deputy, Heydrich, interpreted this message as, quote, one long attack on everything we stand for. The Pope is virtually accusing the German people of injustice toward the Jews and makes himself the mouthpiece of the Jewish war criminals. Pius also continued one of the programs begun by his predecessors. Some 6,000 Jews obtained passports and visas on papal orders. Many were signed by the diplomats interned at Hospice Santa Marta. The Nazis' occupation of Rome in 1943 called for more active measures. Pius ordered monasteries and convents all over Italy to open their enclosures to fleeing Jews. And the redoubtable Monsignor Hugh O'Flaherty, Primo Notario of the Holy Office, put his organization, originally developed to assist escaping POWs, into high gear. Evidently, though O'Flaherty had a brilliant mind, he earned his bachelor's degree in theology in 1 year at the Urban College of the Congregation for the Propagation of the Faith. He was ordained in 1925. He had doctorates in divinity, canon law, and philosophy. After 4 years in the Vatican diplomatic service, he was appointed a notary of the Holy Office. Although many people found him rough-edged, Monsignor O'Flaherty had a stunning success in Roman social high life. This would prove important during the Nazi occupation. He raised some eyebrows, becoming an amateur golf champion of Italy. Diocesan priests of Rome were not allowed to play golf. Monsignor O'Flaherty got his start in smuggling and hiding refugees in the fall of 42, when the Germans and Italians cracked down. O'Flaherty had socialized with these people before the war. Now he hid them in monasteries and convents and in his own residence. In the spring of 43, his operation broadened to include escaped British POWs, and he acquired a most improbable partner, Sir Francis Darcy Godolphin Osborne, British minister to the Vatican. Hugh O'Flaherty had only a standard, modest Irish antipathy toward the British until he was in seminary. Then some of his boyhood friends were killed by the Black and Tans. But O'Flaherty made sure the British POWs were safe in the Vatican. Sir Darcy's status prevented him from leaving the Vatican, so Monsignor O'Flaherty developed a network of apartments in Rome in which they could hide. In September, the Germans occupied Rome. The Italian game of forgetting to round up Jews was over. Vatican officials who had inclined to prudence in ordinary Italians, who had been indifferent to the plight of Jews, were radicalized by the Gestapo. Even the most conservative men in the Vatican were prepared now to give the troubleshooting Monsignor quite a bit more rope. Monsignor O'Flaherty hid Jews in monasteries and convents at Castel Gandolfo, in his old college of the Propaganda Fide, in the German college, and in his network of apartments. Every evening he stood in the porch of St. Peter's, in plain view of both the German soldiers across the piazza and of the windows of the Pope's apartment. Escaped POWs and Jews would come to him there. He would smuggle them across the piazza and through the German cemetery to the college. Sometimes he would disguise them in the robes of a Monsignor or even the uniform of a Swiss guard. One Jew made his way to St. Peter's, and coming up to O'Flaherty where he usually stood at his post and drawing him deeper into the shadow, began to unwind a solid gold chain. It was long enough that he had wound it twice around his waist. The man spoke. My wife and I expect to be arrested at any moment. We have no way of escaping. When we're taken to Germany, we shall die. But we have a small son. He's only 7 and is too young to die in a Nazi gas chamber. Please take this chain and take the boy for us too. Each link of the chain will keep him alive for a month. Will you save him? Monsignor O'Flaherty improved upon this plan. He accepted the chain, hid the boy, and came up with false papers for the parents. At the end of the war, he returned the boy and the chain. Colonel Herbert Kapler, Rome's Gestapo chief, set several traps for Monsignor O'Flaherty. Once he was confronted by a group of Gestapo men. He escaped by a rolling block, a charge into them, and continued running until he was safely inside the doors of Santa Maria Maggiore, extraterritorial property of the church, Another time he was at the palace of Prince Filippo Doria Pamphili, who provided funds for his operations. The SS surrounded the palace. Monsignor Flaherty escaped to the basement, then up a coal chute and away in the coal truck that had been making a delivery. Finally, Colonel Kepler complained to Berlin. Monsignor Flaherty received an invitation to a reception at the Hungarian embassy with an implicit safe conduct. There, Baron von Weizsäcker, the German ambassador, told him, "Nobody in Rome honors you more than I do for what you're doing. But it's gone too far for us all. Kepler is waiting in the hall, feeling rather frustrated. I have told him that you will have safe conduct back to the Vatican tonight. But if you ever step outside Vatican territory again, on whatever pretext, you will be arrested at once. Now, will you please think about what I've said?" O'Flaherty smiled down at von Weizsäcker and replied, "Your Excellency is too considerate. I will certainly think about what you've said, sometimes." Of 9,700 Roman Jews, 1,007 were shipped to Auschwitz. The rest were hidden, 5,000 of them by the official church, 3,000 in the Castel Gandolfo. About 400 as members of the Palatine Guard, and some 1,500 in monasteries, convents, and colleges. The remaining 3,700 were hidden in private homes, including Monsignor Flaherty's network of apartments. After the war, Colonel Kepler was sentenced to life in the Gaeta prison between Rome and Naples. His only visitor was an Irish Monsignor who came once a month. In 1959, Monsignor Flaherty baptized Herbert Kepler into the Catholic Church. Elsewhere in Italy, Pincas Lapide wrote, "Thanks in part to the lifting of the enclosure, it's at least 40,000 Italian Jews and others who had managed to flee Italy, were hidden and saved by humble priests, monks, farmers, and laborers, dozens of whom lost their lives for sheltering them." It makes you think of sheltering words like those in the Beatitudes. "Blessed are the poor in spirit." Israel has enacted strict standards as to the qualification of righteous Gentiles, those who voluntarily underwent personal risk to save Jews, to shelter the Jews. It makes one think of the sheltering words of the Beatitudes, "For theirs is the kingdom of heaven." For each one of these people, a tree is planted along the Avenue of the Righteous, which leads to Heroes and Martyrs Memorial. There's more than 10,000 such trees. Each tree has a label with the name of the brave Gentile that it honors. When Pope Pius XII died, open letters appear in the Israeli press suggesting that 860,000 trees be planted in the hills of Judea. And back to the incredible words of the Beatitudes. "Blessed are they that mourn, for they shall be comforted." In Israel, they planted so many trees that they created a forest, a Pope Pius XII forest. This is Chuck Coughlin on Setting the Record Straight, brought to you on BreadboxMedia.com. May God bless you.